Hello, and thank you for attending Quantitatively Measuring the Softer Outcomes of Giving Kids a World of Good. Well, normally I would ask what your expectations are, but since this is a sort of one-way conversation, that's not applicable here. The goals of the session are a broad understanding of how scales are made, experience using a scale, which won't be applicable now as well either, a broad overview of what actually makes a good measure, consideration of the ethics, and some takeaway examples of scales and further information, which in this case isn't applicable either. But I applaud you for downloading this or ordering this and being interested in measuring what you're doing at camp. So a brief outline is the scale construction and use, what makes a good measure, and the ethics. This is really part of a trilogy of sessions. So how to seriously evaluate your outcomes is really sort of the broad overview of evaluation. Then the measuring the softer outcomes, which is this presentation, goes more in depth into what makes a good measure when you're trying to assess whether or not and to what degree and all the moderators and all the things that go into examining a camp and its outcomes. And the process and implementation evaluation session really deals with examining your processes in detail, how it is you go about achieving what you do. And the implementation evaluation is examining what happens in reality as opposed to more the paper side of things. Now, I can't tell you everything you need to know about evaluation. That would require at least 2 weeks of a residential sort of training or years in graduate school to sort of convey all the information necessary about evaluation, but I will be able to give you kind of an overview of the things that are involved so that you can make informed decisions when you're looking, in this case, at assessing measures. And lastly, evaluation is neither quick, simple, or easy. And I think you'll get that impression if you go through all trilogy of the sessions and through this one as well. So what are we saying when we look at a measure and we say, okay, and this child is going to answer a few questions, or perhaps somebody else is going to answer some questions about the child, the counselor or parent, usually in an hour or less, otherwise people tend to get bored, if not far sooner. And what happens during that answer to a few questions will predict the child's current and future psychological state and life and behavioral outcomes. So that's really what we're saying when we give people these scales to fill out, that we're going to be able to predict the child's current and future psychological state and life and behavioral outcomes. It's quite a statement. So, a little background on how scales are constructed. I think this will be very useful because when you look at scales, you don't really know what goes into them, how they come up. This sort of takes a little bit of the magic out of, you know, that statement, how it is that it happens. This is by far not the whole situation that happens and the whole delineation of steps, but it is an overview that will give you an idea. So the first step is that scientists take the theoretical construct they're trying to capture with the scale, and they make up statements that reflect the concept. So if they're saying, okay, let's see, I want to measure self-esteem, then a bunch of people who know the theory, or the people who are interested in making the scale in this case, in this step, sit around and they say, well, a statement might be someone who has a high self-esteem might strongly agree to something like, I really like myself, or other people enjoy spending time with me, or various statements. So they'll sit around and they'll brainstorm bunches of these up, write them all down. And again, they're using the theory, in this case of self-esteem, to guide their answers. They're not just pulling these out of their hat. They're using the theory to create the statements. So the second step is they say, okay, we've got all these statements down. Now, this was just me or a couple other people who were involved at this point. Let's bring in some other people who really don't know us, but do know the theory, self-esteem, whatever it is, and have them evaluate the statements. So then you give all the statements. Sometimes it's a few, maybe 30. Sometimes it's a lot, 200. And these judges go over and evaluate them. And they will offer comments. Maybe you should reword this sentence this way or this statement, or maybe you want to change the way you're rating the scale. or maybe these statements really aren't accurate and you should throw those out, this kind of thing. So after that step is done, the third step is that the scale is actually constructed, and it's tested with several hundreds or thousands of people. So they give the scale to bunches of people, usually the population of interest that they want to assess in the end, and they'll have them take it. So these people will fill out usually lengthy measures. So if it were self-esteem, maybe they'll fill out 200 items. Sometimes they do it slightly differently with matrix sampling, but that's a whole different ballgame. So they go through and they test it. Next thing they do, they get all that information back, pop it into the computer, and the fourth step is they do something called statistical factor analysis. And basically what that does is it makes clumps out of all these questions. So self-esteem, to stick with that as an example, has various clumps. You could say there's this self-esteem about your intelligence, your self-esteem about your body, self-esteem about your social abilities, self-esteem about your work, self-esteem about personal relationship, all sorts of things. So certain questions may reflect certain domains, and the computer will go through and through correlations and complicated statistical analyses will try and group them. And that's a good thing to do because this isn't a person doing it. It's this computer that are using everybody's answers to see if it can group factors out. Anyway, this is all fairly complex, and I can't hope to impart on you what actually goes on at this point. But this is a very useful step to make little groupings about what makes scales, and also to eliminate items that don't contribute to scale factors. So they thought these questions were a great idea. Reality, they didn't group up with anything else. They throw them out. If the scale is sort of unidimensional, it only has like one aspect to it, like just global self-esteem and not domains, then you would hope that this step would yield only one factor. Okay, so you go through that. This step is to assess things like test, retest reliability, and if applicable, iterator reliability. So you would want to know how stable this assessment is. So for self-esteem again, you give it to people, you give it to them a week or two later, and you say, okay, well, how well do these scores correlate with each other? How much are they the same from time one to time two? And usually you do this with several time spans in between. And you want to know how reliable the test is, because assessments should be very, very reliable. Otherwise, if you're assessing something, say, the beginning and end of camp, if it isn't reliable, then at the end, you don't know if you've really measured a change or if you're just measuring this unreliability in the scale itself. So then you go on, sixth step, and, oh, iterator reliability is just, if applicable, you'll have other people rate the same person on something. So let's say it's social skills, to use that. You'll have two people rate the same child on their self-control ability. And if the scale has high iterator reliability, these people would agree as to this child's social skills, or in this case, self-control, domain of it. Step six, obtain evidence of discriminant validity. Discriminant validity is the ability of a scale to discriminate against groups. So it might be discriminate children who, for self-esteem, those who are depressed and those who aren't depressed, children who do well in school versus those who don't, although self-esteem isn't very good as a discriminating group. Predictive validity is very, very similar, but this is step seven now, but still a little bit different. And predictive validity is talking about measuring some other, usually behavioral and sometimes psychological state based on the scores on a particular scale. So you would want to know whether self-esteem is predictive of grades, or predictive of friendships, or predictive of whether or not children take on goals in the future. You'd want to know that sort of thing. For environmental attitudes and awareness, you'd want to know that what children answer on the scale is predictive of their environmental behaviors later on. Eight, shorten the scale as much as possible while retaining scale integrity. In reality, this step probably happens between step four and five, because people generally do not like filling out incredibly long measures, so they try and shorten them up as much as possible while still retaining the reliability, discriminant, and predictive validity thing. So this is just a broad overview again. I could spend an entire session just talking about each of these steps, but this gives you hopefully a broad overview. So normally I'd go through an example with social skills now of actually having the participants take a social skills assessment where they're rating a child, and then have them look at how scales are computed, looking at the norms, iterator reliability, all the issues that go into actually assessing a scale and using it in reality. But in this case, that is impossible. In the handout, again, these are things that are not available in the presentations themselves, and in this case, it's because scales cannot be provided without people agreeing not to duplicate them, not to use them without meeting very, very specific psychological standards. So those things are not available unless that form is signed. But these are some other things that would be in the handout, and these are examples of types of scales. And I'll have a further example later on. So in brief, what is validity and reliability? Validity is what you're attempting to measure, is what is actually being measured. So if you're measuring self-esteem, what you want the measure, if it's a valid measure, what you really get when the child sits down and answers these 10 or 80 questions is a measure of their self-esteem, not something else. The assessment can discriminate between groups, again that's discriminant validity, and predict future outcomes and behaviors, predictive validity. Again, this is in brief, we'll touch on this more later. Reliability is when the outcome is assessed again in a short period of time, stable outcomes should remain the same, and unstable outcomes should vary. Mood from time to time varies quite a bit, so you wouldn't expect a very stable score on something like that. And independent raters, this is iterator reliability, should come up with the same conclusion. So why is it so critical to have a scale that meets the exhaustive criteria? And this is really why I'm doing this presentation and including all this information, is because I found, you know, there's over 200 studies of camping outcomes, and I've looked at quite a few of them. And by and large, they tend not to use scales that are meet the criteria for a solid instrument. And it's because of that that one really doesn't understand the results. The results can be a bit confusing. Let me give you an example of that. So a consistent finding indicates that the number of summers of camp attendance in session length, so whether you're camp for one summer or five summers, or whether the session is 5 days or 8 weeks, do not make a difference. Now, while that's on all sorts of outcomes, self-esteem, environmental attitudes and awareness, friendship, all sorts of things. Now, while that's possible, it is definitely puzzling to understand why 5 days is as good as 8 weeks, or why one summer is as good as four or more across a host of outcomes. I mean, I personally can't understand why that would be the case. It's very puzzling. My thinking is that it's because they aren't using measures that meet all the criteria, and thus the results are puzzling like this. Another example is Search Institute's massive survey, over 100,000 children, of 40 developmental assets, which leaves us with a quandary, with concluding that either the vast majority of the assets contribute nothing toward avoiding negative behaviors, or that the survey is invalid. And we really don't know what to conclude here. You know, you sort of have to take, because they don't provide enough information about whether or not their scale is valid and reliable. So you're left concluding, well, maybe it's just a few things that, a few assets that matter in avoiding negative behaviors, or perhaps the survey is invalid. You really don't know. And lastly, you want to know the truth. And you really need to know what is actually going on to truly help your campers. You can't help your campers achieve outcomes, and you can't help your camp really towards that end, and your parents and everyone involved, without knowing what is in fact going on. If you use some invalid measure, or measures that don't meet all the criteria, you might end up with all sorts of strange results, like the 5 days as good as 8 weeks. Or it might show that, you know, campers benefited when really they didn't, or vice versa. all sorts of strange things might happen. And what are you going to do with that information? Perhaps you'll change things, perhaps you won't. Perhaps you'll do more harm by changing something that was actually good. Perhaps, you know, all sorts of changes or initiatives or decisions might be made on data that really has nothing to do with what's actually going on. That's why it's absolutely critical and necessary to meet all the criteria for a good psychological measure. So what exactly makes a good measure? These are all quoted directly from methodological and psychometric considerations in Child Report, and the reference follows a little bit later. And I really like this delineation because it's fairly comprehensive, and it's a nice little quick question-oriented way of assessing a measure's worth. So we're just going to go through these all quickly. The first is, how was the test developed? Number one, did the test developers use widely accepted procedures, i.e., is it consistent with APA, American Psychological Association, standards? The APA has very strict guidelines on what makes an acceptable method of assessing a scale's utility. And if you don't have those guidelines, you're not really sure how the person came up with whether or not they thought it was a good measure or not. And that reference is included later as well. Was the test sample representative of the population you plan to use the test with? So, if a measure was used with a clinically depressed sample, that probably isn't going to be a good one for a normal sample. They probably differ quite a bit. Likewise, you might find a scale that was developed with Muslim children or with African Americans. And maybe it might be useful for the general population, maybe it might not be. It's important to know what sample the population was used to validate the test or to come up with the psychometrics and criteria for a good measure, and what population you actually want to use it with. Also, was the test developed on large enough samples? You really need to have a representative sample to say that when you use this scale later, with all sorts of people, across the United States, perhaps across cultures, whatever, you want to be sure that the scale has a large enough number of people in its development, you know, stages, so that is representative. And that's going to be a fairly large number. You'd probably want to see a scale that has at least 1,000 people in it. And depending on the population of interest, that number is going to vary. But you want to see a fairly large number. And are the data for evaluating the test current? If the scale was constructed in the 1970s, is it still applicable today? People's attitudes have changed, you know, we're now in the Gen Xers, all this sort of thing. People might not read the questions with the same frame of mind as when the people who originally tested and validated the instrument. Has the test been evaluated and results published by researchers other than the test developers? So if the test developers are the only people who used the methods to come up with whether or not it was reliable and valid data, that might lead cause for concern, because maybe they're missing something, or maybe they chose certain things either advertently or inadvertently that might yield different results if someone else were to do it. So you really want to see that other people have gone in and taken a hard look at this scale or this measure and to see if it truly is reliable and valid and useful for the populations and needs desired. And you want to see if the results are published, because a published report goes through a peer review process if it's in a peer review journal. So you might have four or five other people who are knowledgeable about this sort of scale design and construct, and also the theory involved, self-esteem or environmental awareness, whatever, who'll be able to tell you whether or not it's a good one. And if they accept it for publication, you know, it probably passed at least their minimum standards. And lastly, do the test procedures reflect an appreciation for the unique characteristics of the children? So is it age appropriate for the child's reading ability, their cognitive ability? You know, older children have a longer attention span, they're able to understand more complex sentiments, so you want to make sure that all of those are appropriate. So, criteria 2 of 2. Is the test reliable? Are the indices of internal consistency high enough? Coefficients above 0.08, 1.80, and what that refers to is Cronbach's alpha, and I'm just not going to go into that. Basically, it refers to how well scale items correlate with themselves, and you want to make sure that all of these are above 0.0, and I'll just leave it there. Are the scales or scores stable over time? Again, we talked about this already, and is the time span used to assess stability relevant to your purposes? So, if you're going to be measuring over a period of 3 weeks, you'd want to know whether or not the scale scores are reliable and stable over that period of time. When inter-score or inter-observer consistency is reported, are the reporters appropriate? So you'd want to know if you're going to use it for a parent and a counselor, and are there inter-score or inter-observer consistency ratings, you'd want to know if that's an appropriate use. Does it work for social skills, for example? There are complex issues involved, such as the counselor having a totally different perspective. They see the child in a different environment, so maybe that isn't the best way to do it. Also, especially if it's done at the beginning of camp, the counselor may not know the child well enough to really accurately assess the child. Number four is just sort of summative. When more than one form of reliability is appropriate, are all relevant data reported? So 3 of 3, is the test valid? Number one, in your opinion, do the test items measure what they are said to measure? And this is really talking about content and face validity. And when I was talking about scale construction earlier, this is when the people use the theory and they evaluate the statements to see if they are in line with the theory. So for self-esteem, you'd want to make sure the statements really reflect self-esteem theory. Environmental attitudes, awareness, social skills, etc., do you want to make sure that they have face validity? When you read the statement, it's not like, what is that? That has nothing to do with self-esteem. You don't want that to happen. Second step, or point, is the nature of the validity data consistent with your uses? If your research or clinical question is predictive, is the predictive validity of the measure reported? This one is really, really important. And what people lament over all the time is that scales used to assess interventions usually don't have predictive validity reported. And you really want that point or that criterion in there. Because what you're trying to do is say, okay, the change score, say on self-esteem, environmental attitudes, or whatever, the scores these children have at the end of camp are better than the beginning of camp, and that means something. That means that these children will do better in their school, that they will do better in observing and appreciating the environment, all these sorts of things. If you don't have predictive validity, then you don't have any assurances of that. And you really have to have those when assessing an intervention. Very few scales really have predictive validity criteria published. And it is definitely an enormous problem within the industry itself. When the test is designed to discriminate among groups, do the test scores actually differ among group samples? So you'd want to know that if you're trying to discriminate amongst depressed and non-depressed people, you'd want to say, okay, well, does the self-esteem scale discriminate between depressed and non-depressed? Does this environmental scale discriminate against people who make greener decisions and those who don't? Which is somewhat like predictive validity, but it isn't sort of looking into the future. It's kind of right now, can we discriminate between groups? Both of those are extremely important. Are normative data reported? And are they relevant to the population you will use the test with? This is also extremely important. You want to know what a clinically meaningful change is. So if you've used this 1 to 80 scale and you say these children on average went from 67 to 69 points, okay, but is that meaningful? Is that clinically meaningful? What does that mean in reality? And that, which sort of goes back to predictive and discriminant validity, but in this case, you also want to know what the averages are for people. What are the norms for people who are depressed? What are the norms for people who are in prison? What are the norms for you know, Caucasians? What are the norms for at-risk youth? You want to know that information. Number 5. Do test scores correlate with theoretically meaningful variables and uncorrelate with theoretically irrelevant variables? This is really a type of validity when people are constructing scales. Similar to discriminant validity, they want to know if, you know, self-esteem and depression, again, let's stick with the example, that they should not be highly correlated with each other. If they are, you'd really wonder if there was some kind of problem with the theories here, how the scales were constructed, because you wouldn't expect high self-esteem to be related to depression. But you would expect self-esteem to be correlated with things like general self-efficacy, or self-confidence, independence, and or future sense of self, something like that. And has validity evidence been replicated, especially by someone other than the test developer? Again, we've already touched on this. And the last point is evidence of construct validity reported, and if so, is it persuasive? And this is basically, is this a real construct? Is, you know, originally they were like, well, we got this thing, we've measured self-esteem, is that real? Is it something unique? Is it not really sort of a combination of a bunch of other things? Is this a unique theoretical construct? And that's really theory building, but for things that CAMP are usually going to be measuring, this isn't so much the case. Where that might be the case a little bit more is something like spirituality. Spirituality is a construct that is kind of not well defined and not well measured. So that's an area where construct validity is perhaps a bit weak. And several people define spirituality differently. Okay, criteria 4 of 4. So how practical is the measure? Can the child understand the test items? Is it, you know, above their level of ability to understand them? Do they understand the words? I once gave the scale to children, and a word in there was middle class. And the children didn't understand what middle class was. So that had to be explained. Is the testing time within the attention span of the child? Young children definitely do not have a long attention span. And when that starts to drift, the reliability and validity of the scale tend to go into the toilet. So you got to make sure that it's within the attention span of the child. You know, teenagers and such, late childhood, they can do quite a bit more. Is the information to be provided within the child's ability or experiences to report? Again, this abilities, reading, cognitive level here, an experience to report, you know, have they had, if it asks them about, you know, some particular experience, such as, you know, doing drugs or being in dangerous, you know, situations of certain sorts, you know, have they had that sort of experience and can they report on those? It can also refer to psychological experiences. 4. Will a child cooperate with test procedures? Again, this gets to motivation and honesty, which I've touched on before, and I'm going to touch on this more in just a second, so I'll leave that for now, but it has to do with motivation and honesty. Is the measure sensitive to change? You want them to be sure that if you're trying to assess if CAMP has an outcome on children, and you do sort of this beginning end of CAMP design, you want to make sure that the scale you're using will pick up a change that's there, a meaningful change that's there. This is, I think, the problem with some of the Search Institute measures. For, among other things, they don't report information on the reliability and validity, very scant anyway. But three-item scale is unlikely to really probably yield a sensitive enough measure that you would be able to pick up change. Also, sensitivity is important in things like the state versus trait. So, a couple levels on self-esteem, for example, there's things called barometric and baseline self-esteem. Baseline self-esteem is a pretty darn stable sense of self. And from the ages of, say, 9 to 16 to 18, you're going to find that somebody's baseline self-esteem is probably going to be darn near the same. In fact, they've done these studies, and it is. Now, barometric self-esteem is a bit more of the bad hair day kind of thing. That fluctuates all the time. So that goes up when you're happy, down when you're not. You know, if you're complimented, it goes up. If, you know, someone gives you a slight, it goes down. Good grade, bad grade, all that sort of thing. But in general, people's baseline sense of self tends to stay the same. When you're picking a measure, you want to be sure that you've got the right one. If you're looking for an enduring sense of change and predictive validity, you're going to want to pick a baseline self-esteem measure as opposed to a more trait measure of it. And all that gets far more complicated, but I'm just going to leave it there for now. So how reactive is the instrument? Sometimes instruments have questions that are very reactive. Like, for example, the Josephson Ethics Institute did these surveys, and they asked very sensitive questions, such as, you know, have you ever stolen, you know, have you ever engaged in any violence, do you cheat, all these sorts of things. These are very reactive questions, so you might not get the answers that reflect reality. And can the responses be easily biased? So can the child really figure out what the scale is trying to ask and try and sway it to the way they want to be portrayed? Sort of impression management kind of thing. There's all sorts of things that scales do to sort of protect against this. They include an impression management scale sometimes, positive, negative impression. They check for consistencies. They'll, you know, phrase the question just a tiny bit different, maybe 10 or 12 questions later, see if the child answers that the same, that kind of thing. And usually a scale for anything like self-esteem is made up of several items and often also interspersed amongst others, so that makes it more difficult for the child to figure out what you're trying to get at. And lastly, does the quality of the data match the amount of effort to collect it? Which is a very important question for camps involved and anyone interested in assessing an intervention, because collecting information about the outcomes of a summer camp experience is a very tedious procedure. And you want to make sure that if you're going to go through it, what you get is very meaningful and valid. So some quick issues about ability, motivation, and honesty. Ability, as we mentioned, things like age, ability to understand the scale, what to do about that, pick appropriate measures, and if you're unable to find a measure that works with the age interested, adjust the ages that are to be studied. One example of this is self-esteem before the age of 8 tends to be a dodgy, at best, thing to measure. Motivation. They're bored, they don't care, they could care less about this measure, they might answer randomly, they might answer just, you know, I'll just toy with them, whatever. Some ways to sort of get around that are check for consistency amongst answers, to sincerely ask for them their help, to give the participant a choice as to whether or not they participate or not is often very powerful, and to offer a $2 bill attached to the survey. I usually include a note that says, thanks for your time and honesty. By accepting that and then lying, you know, triggers the old guilt response there and tends to be pretty powerful in terms of helping the motivation factor and the honesty. And on the honesty, social desirable responding is a problem, answering to make themselves look more positive than they are, which can be and often is a more subconscious than conscious decision, or flat out attempts at deception. Here, including a positive and negative impression scale is often helpful, and a $2 bill also helps with these issues. Here's the sources I mentioned before. Fairly recent, American Educational Research Association, Standard for Educational and Psychological Testing. The questions that I was just listing from were from this great book that talks about all these issues quite in depth through the eyes of a child. And lastly, a recent book, The Use of Psychological Testament for Treatment Planning and Outcome Assessment, is another good source to examine. So those are just for your reference. Ethics and consent forms. Participants have the following rights. They have the right to withdraw from the study without any duress or consequences. If they choose to drop out, nothing can be done. Just say okay, acknowledge it, that's it. No consequences of any sort can result from their dropping out. They must be informed about the research project on the whole. This doesn't include nitty-gritty. Participants rarely care, rarely want to read all that, but a brief one-paragraph description for the people involved is appropriate. And it's often carefully worded because you don't want to bias people's responses based on what you tell them here. They need to understand their responsibilities. They must be informed about if and how their responses will be kept confidential. Confidentiality is pretty necessary. There's, you know, it would require extreme conditions for it not to be kept confidential. And it's rarely, if ever, done. And it depends on the measure, but it's extraordinarily rare. It's almost necessary that the responses will be kept confidential, will not come back to harm them in any way. Educational testing might be the only, might be one of the few exceptions to this. And they're given a realistic appraisal of the risks of their participation. And lastly, they have impartial avenues to express their concerns. So, beyond the people who are actually conducting the study, if they have a problem with the way things are going, they have somebody else to contact. Next point, major point here, is that parents are not informed about their child's scale scores on psychometric measures and vice versa. On self-esteem, IQ, all these things, parents are not informed, nor are children informed of the scores. That is considered unethical. And a review board assesses risks, gains, and worthiness. An internal review board, or IRB, is, in universities, it is required. And in government-funded studies, it is required. Private studies, it isn't so much so required as it is good to do. But you would definitely want to have a board, independent of you, evaluate your study to see if you're meeting the criteria necessary for conducting an ethical investigation. And they also assess if the trouble, all the trouble that you're going to make people go through filling out these scales or doing these things is worthwhile, that the data gathered at the end is going to be useful to society and to the camp or to whoever, and justify the time and expense involved. Now, even once you go through all of this and you've got your measures and you pick them all out, what is still often unknown, and again this applies for each outcome involved, is what are the processes involved. Again, that goes to a different presentation entirely, which addresses how to look at the processes, what it is about camp that leads to certain outcomes. What is the magnitude of effect? Now, if you do conduct a question with the scales, although this is often not reported, it is necessary to know. That is, what do you have? Do you have a small, a medium, a large effect on these children? Very, very important to know. How many people benefit? Different than the magnitude is, do, you know, 30, if you have 100 kids who go through this, do 30 benefit? Do maybe 70 benefit a little bit and 20 benefit a lot? You know, to know that. And also to know who does and does not benefit and why. On this host of moderating variables that I have listed here, such as age, ethnicity, you know, gender, do males differ than females on their outcomes and why? The number of summers, is one summer enough, or do several summers are more necessary in order to get the benefits? Socioeconomic levels, do children who are poor or living in poverty do better or worse than those who aren't? The parenting style, family functioning, child's desire to go to camp, counselor group performance, level on the outcomes, so whether or not the child has a high, medium, or low level on self-esteem and whether or not that influences the outcome, whether or not the parent went to camp or not, if the child has a positive environment elsewhere, and so that might make a difference, if they have a really good school or they're really active in a positive religious community, perhaps those things are powerful environments that help the child, therefore the child might not benefit as much from a camp experience. Strong positive peer group, same thing. Is the child a good match with the camp? Maybe the child would do better in a decentralized setting. Maybe they do better in day camp. This sort of thing. Other individual and social traits aren't listed here. Idiosyncratic experiences at camp. For example, the child happened to be the picked on child in the group, and therefore they didn't benefit. It's important to know that sort of thing. in the variability that isn't captured by all of these variables, such as, you know, categories, such as ethnicity. You know, just because someone writes down African American does not mean that all African Americans have the same sort of experience, as we know for sure. Same for Caucasian and such and such. Or gender, even. So just knowing this sort of category of gender, or category of ethnicity, is just this really broad, rough cut, you know, if you measure it that way. So there's a lot of variability that isn't captured just by these rough cuts. A few other things that are unknown are, do you help any child, or just the population served, which gets back to sort of the needs assessment question, which is talked about in the session that is about evaluation in general. How long does the effect last? Does it last 2, 4, 12, 20 weeks after camp? How would you be able to tell an adult camper apart from a non-camper, similar in every other way? These are extremely important questions, which gets more into the how the study was designed as opposed to the measure itself. And lastly, could the benefit be achieved elsewhere, cheaper or better? So the session length, if yours is 4 weeks, could they really achieve the benefit in one? The type of programming involved, perhaps, you know, a camp experience is nice, but they can get it through a different type of programming, cheaper, better, or some sort of other intervention. Some demographic variables to throw out there that are useful to look at: number of summers, length of camp attendance, parental camp experience. If the parent went to camp and they achieved all these benefits, then they should be hopefully imparting those benefits that they received to their child as well. So you would think that perhaps children who have been to camp, or rather if a parent has gone to camp, their child should be higher than those who haven't been to camp. It's worth looking at. Child's desire to go to camp, gender, ethnicity, etc., etc. Behavioral variables. It's important to look at not just these psychometric variables, but also to look at real behaviors measured, such as antisocial behavior, if that is able, information is available, violence, if that information is available, television and media use, the child's actual grades, their detentions and formal reprimands in schools, if it's spirituality and church or that sort of thing, their church attendance, related activities, if camp is supposed to inspire all these newfound interests and activities, how many new activities and interests are engaged in after camp? If camp is a sense of community, valuing community, being more helpful, all these sort of things, what actually happens? What's the frequency of the child's, you know, being helpful around the community and the house? What are the actual behaviors? And tobacco and alcohol, just as a few little brief list of some other behavioral indicators. I also wanted to throw in a quick list of outcomes of the camp experience. Now, this isn't meant, I briefly categorized them in cognitive, emotional, and behavioral. I did that only as a rough cut. They really could all blend across the three, but I decided to do this for ease of presentation. But you can see here that there's a lot of potential outcomes of the camp experience. So here's just a brief list of things to consider. And that's it. So, normally I'd ask for questions and discussion right now, but since you're listening to this and weren't actually able to participate in the session, I invite you to email me. And you can go to the website and get my email address, and I'd be happy to answer any questions and offer some discussion.